From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Does a new satellite image out of North Korea mean that that country's promised Christmas gift to the U.S. is a missile launch, as suspected? Nuclear talks between the U.S. and North Korea have stalled. Some analysts believe that North Korea's leader, furious about sanctions, sees President Trump as weakened by impeachment. And last night, Trump's former National Security Advisor, John Bolton, called out his former boss, telling Axios, "The idea that we are somehow exerting maximum pressure on North Korea is just unfortunately not true." Joel Witt is director of the 38 North Project, which offers analysis on North Korea. He's also a former State Department official. Joel, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And I want to get to John Bolton's comments, but first this picture. It comes from a military equipment factory near Pyongyang from an American company, Planet Labs. What does it show?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of, I think the picture doesn't show what a lot of media outlets are saying it shows. Mm. What the picture shows is the expansion of a factory that produces launchers for mobile missiles for North Korea. By mobile missiles, you know, you need to have a truck that drives them around.
Right.
So this produces those launchers. And it's expanded. So that means the North Koreans are producing these launchers, but it doesn't mean that they're going to launch a missile, you know, on Christmas Day or anytime soon.
So this doesn't, when I say it's adding to speculation, not on your part?
Not on my part, not on the part of anyone who's a careful analyst of satellite photography. It shows that North Korea is building missiles, building launchers, but it doesn't mean they're going to launch the missile right away.
Okay, but what do you think in general of the threat of a Christmas gift for the U.S.? What do you take?
Well, my take is that it's quite possible, but there's no evidence to suggest it's going to happen, except that the North Koreans have said something bad is going to happen by the end of the year.
Well, and you also couple that with John Bolton being critical of his former boss. Now, we should put this in a political context. He's also been making noise about how he knows things that might be important in the impeachment process, and yet he's not come forward to testify. Some people, you know, feel he's, you know, selling a book or maybe, you know, getting some kind of payback. Because we remember when the president met Kim Jong-un at the demilitarized zone, John Bolton was shut out of that visit. I think, you know, Tucker Carlson from Fox News went on that historic trip. Not John Bolton. He was seen as, you know, being pushed out of the Trump administration. How do you take his comments, very critical of President Trump's Korea, North Korea strategy?
Well, most people forget that John Bolton is a neoconservative. And as a neoconservative, he is responsible for having destroyed the 1994 denuclearization deal that basically stopped North Korea's nuclear program.
And we should say you worked on.
Yes, that I worked on. And then subsequently, the Bush administration and John Bolton and others basically backed out of the deal. And what's really funny is whenever you would meet with North Koreans after that, they would sort of sarcastically refer to John Bolton as the father of their nuclear weapons program because of what he had done. So John Bolton really does have an axe to grind here that goes not just towards President Trump, but even beyond that in his general foreign policy philosophy.
Well, and what do you think happens now? Because, you know, there has been this threat of a Christmas gift. The nuclear talks have gone nowhere. President Trump, when he met with Kim Jong-un in Singapore a year and a half ago, he said he knew for a fact that the Korean leader would go home and change his ways. And of course, you know, he hasn't. He said there would be denuclearization. There hasn't been. What happens?
Well, what happens now is not going to be good. In fact, the North Koreans have started to shift gears, and it's been very clear for a couple of months now that they are ramping up to do a lot of bad things. It could include an ICBM test. It could include nuclear tests. We just don't know, and it may unfold very quickly or very gradually into the next year.
And as you well know, North Korea wants the U.S. to lift its economic sanctions. The U.S. wants North Korea to halt its nuclear program. It doesn't feel as if there'll be any movement on either side of that equation.
Well, I, you know, in this case, I have to say that the Trump administration has been sending signals to North Korea that it's willing to compromise on a lot of different issues. I think the problem is, earlier than that, the North Koreans concluded that this was a waste of their time. And they've been on this trajectory for the past, I would say, 6 months, mm-hmm. or even more, certainly since the Hanoi summit earlier this year. Things have been going downhill.
Joel Witt, senior fellow at the Henry Stimson Center, director of the 38 North Project. Joel, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, it goes without saying that it has been a head-spinning political decade. Barack Obama was our president when it started. Donald Trump is president as the decade ends. So how did America go from one to the other? Julian Zelizer and Kevin Cruz write about this in a recent USA Today column. They're both historians at Princeton University, and Julian joins us now to talk about it. Hey, Julian, glad to have you here to talk about this.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with President Obama's relationship with Republicans. You write that from the beginning, President Obama offered an olive branch after olive branch to Republicans who repeatedly swatted them away. As a political strategy, you also write that this ultimately worked for Republicans. How so?
Well, Obama miscalculated. One of his core ideas when becoming president was that he could push the country into a post-partisan period, that there were ways to break through the partisan divide that had taken hold. And so a lot of his early policies in a moment of crisis, including the economic stimulus and financial regulation, and even health care, were shaped with the idea of winning over Republican moderates. But in the end, he got very few votes from the Republicans. And instead, the GOP used his various policies as a way to mobilize their party against him and to block him from being able to do much, especially after the 2010 midterms when they took over the House.
Yeah, and you say this set the stage for Donald Trump. How so?
Well, you see the radicalization of the Republican Party that was taking shape after 2010. The Tea Party comes to Washington, and they embrace a style of Republican politics which is familiar today. Partisanship takes a precedent over a preference over governance. The party uses the conservative media as a way to govern, and legislating is not really a priority. And so all those elements have been central to the Trump presidency.
Yeah, let's talk about something else. Something like 6 million to 9 million Americans who voted for Obama jumped party lines and voted for Trump in 2016. And political scientists who study this have argued that voters were motivated by racial resentment and hostile sexism versus economic stress. Can you talk a little bit about how this fits into this conversation?
Yeah, originally the argument was they voted because of the economy, but political scientists have really found that attitudes about race and gender were really important to those vote flippers. In part, what happened was they had been Republicans, but in 2008 voted for Obama in a moment of crisis. But more importantly, Obama's presence in the White House over time fueled these tensions. And President Trump, Donald Trump as candidate, understood some of this, and his rhetoric played into these anxieties. It continues to do so, and it has been part of his cultural political appeal.
Yeah, and he's really seemed to double down on all of this sentiment, including his relationship with the Republicans, hasn't he? Can you talk a little bit about really doubling down on this sentiment that Americans have who support him, some of them who support him?
Yeah, if we start the decade with Obama imagining a post-partisan world and trying to figure out is bipartisanship possible, Trump is very different. He understands how divided the country is, and he takes a deep dive into the most partisan elements of his party. And so what we've seen pretty consistently, whether it's in policy or his rhetoric, he plays into that. He's not trying to build a broad coalition. He's not trying to reach into the blue territory of this country. Instead, what he has tried to do is to solidify the Republican Party around him, even those who don't like him. And that's the bet that he's making going into 2020.
You know, as we look forward to impeachment, to when that happens in 2020, when it enters the Senate, we spoke with a Trump supporter from Pennsylvania last week who said impeachment would be a good thing for President Trump because it will make his supporters even angrier and likely to galvanize at the polls. Do you see this as a likely scenario?
Yeah, I'm not sure that's true. In some ways, that's the misconception that Obama had, that if you avoided doing certain things and if you avoided certain issues, you could kind of win over some Republicans. I think Trump's base is angry already. I think they are behind him 100%. And I think, sure, impeachment plays into that sentiment. But if impeachment wasn't happening, there would be something else. And so I think that is some of the faulty premise of how Democrats think about the politics of the moment.
Yeah, with the 30 seconds I have with you, how do you think Democrats are going to handle the Senate trial, especially having so many senators running for president?
I think in the end, Senator McConnell is going to make it a quick trial because he wants to move forward, and that will solve the Democrats' problem for them politically.
Yeah. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. As always, Julian, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The glorious sound of the choir of King's College, Cambridge, under the direction of Sir David Wilcox and Sir Andrew Davies, performing Once in Royal David's City. Is there any more glorious way to celebrate Christmas than with the sound of human voices? We thought we'd listen to a few a cappella favorites with our favorite Jewish Christmas elf, Ron Cohen, Mr. Christmas, my former choir director from JFK High School in Plainview, Long Island, New York. Mr. Cohen, welcome.
Shalom, Robin. It's great to be here.
Wonderful to see you. And there's a particular part of Once in Royal David's City you wanted us to hear. Why is this important to you? This is a processional.
A processional, which we did at all our concerts, is like an introduction. It gets people into it. And you know what else? Mm-hmm. When you have an introduction, you know this one? Mm-hmm. Thrum thump,
Mickey Mouse.
Yum pa da ba da 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 da. And what is it? It's like the Empire. I can't wait to see the new Star Wars movie.
Okay. So back to the processional in this piece. What are we seeing here as we hear it?
Okay. So listeners, close your eyes out there.
Okay.
Picture you're sitting down at a concert. You're waiting for it to begin. The lights go down. And then you hear the strains of a single solitary voice from a 10-year-old boy. It started in 1918 with King's College and still going on. That one little boy every year. It is better to light a candle than a curse of darkness. And he is a symbol of hope. He's a symbol of joy, and this is what you hear.
As he holds a candle and walks in, let's listen. Just beautiful. And a reminder, by the way, if you're taken by this music, we're going to have all of Mr. Cohen's suggestions at hereandnow.org. With that voice in our hearts and minds now, I want to turn to your second piece, Noel Cannon, performed here by Chanticleer. Let's just listen a little.
Noel, Noel, sing we, Noel, sing we, oh, 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 and some Noel, Noel, sing we. Sing we, Noel, oh, sing we, Noel, sing we.
And for those listening at home, Mr. Cohen is conducting here in the studio. Noel Cannon, composed in 1993 by Stephen Sammet, a professor at Lehigh University, but it's based on a medieval carol. Tell us why this grabs your ear.
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting to talk about the fact that it's called a canon. Not C-A-N-N-O-N, but C-A-N-O-N. Mm-hmm. And a canon and a round are very similar. A round is a simple theme like, let's always say, row, row, row your boat, which everybody knows are Three Blind Mice or Frère Jacques, and it keeps on repeating when you get to the end of the thematic material over and over, round and round. But a canon is much more interesting, in my opinion, because you get the thematic material, and then when it comes in, the original material keeps on going to new
somewhere else.
Yeah. So it's in this case, it's a four-part canon that we're listening to. Yeah. It's really cool.
Okay. And in this particular one, you want to point out the rhythm.
Yes. It keeps on switching and alternating from 3-4 to 6-8. That is really cool.
So that is Noel Canon. Now a classic, The Little Drummer Boy, performed by the group that we love, Pentatonix. Let's listen.
Come, they told me, ba-ra-ba-ba-ba, a newborn king to see, ba-ra-ba-ba-ba.
Our finest gifts we bring, ba-ra-ba-ba-ba.
Written by the teacher and classical music composer Catherine Davis in 1941. Of course, it's the story of the poor little boy who is summoned by the Magi to the Nativity of Jesus. And you remind us, by the way, first recorded in 1951 by the Trapp Family Singers, who, of course, escaped the Nazis and moved to Vermont and became a singing group. But you also want to juxtapose it with another favorite of ours. Go ahead.
Okay, so The Little Drummer Boy has nothing to offer the Christ child, but is playing on a little drum.
Shall I play for you, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum.
And that reminds me of my favorite little thing that I brought on with you a few years ago.
Absolutely.
Amal and the Night Visitors. Mm-hmm. And Amal is going to give his crutch, and his mother says, oh no, but he goes to give his crutch because that's all he's got to offer, and he gets healed.
And the kings, the three kings, with all of their gifts watching, see that this little boy who only had a crutch to offer is...
And they start singing, he walks,
he walks.
He walks. Yeah, bum, 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 bada, bum, bum. Oh my God, it's so full of joy because that's what Jesus Christ wants.
So we got a twofer there, Amal and the Night Visitors and Little Drummer Boy. Let's move now to Agnus Dei 2 from the Missa Brevis by Palestrina, published in 1570 by Palestrina, the Italian Renaissance composer of sacred music, performed by Siglo d'Oro. Mr. Cohen, here I know you are conducting as if in a blissful dream. Here's where you want us to, I mean, we're listening to these voices, so compelling, and really think about the word a cappella.
And you know what, Robin? Everybody that understands the meaning of a cappella means it means music without accompaniment. However, back in those days, a cappella literally meant at the chapel. And instruments were considered secular, and in some extreme cases, music of the devil. You know, Robin, the human voice is really our first instrument. There's a very famous choral conductor named Father Finn in the early 1900s, and he wrote a book about this where he says, Well, instruments are made out of wooden metal. They can be robotic, but the human voice, the chorus, it can worship, it can love, it can hate, it can plead, it can threaten, it can do a lot of things. And all of that can go into the music.
You used to tell us that it's just the most intimate, it's breath. It's someone's breath. It's what keeps you alive.
Robin, I'm prejudiced, but there's nothing like singing in a choir.
Mm.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And there's nothing like the human voice. The thing that comes the closest to it really is the viola to a human voice.
Okay. Let's end with human voices. O Holy Night, composed by Adolphe Adama in 1847. A French poem at the basis of this. Let's listen.
The thrill of hope, the weary world rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn.
One of your favorite groups, by the way, Home Free. But also, when you hear the song, for many of us, there are memories attached to it. You know, maybe you went Christmas caroling with in your neighborhood, or for you. And by the way, a young Jewish boy, you have a very strong memory.
When I was going to high school, in my sophomore year, we did a Christmas assembly. Today they're called winter concerts, but it was a Christmas assembly. And there was a young fella who was an athletic kind of guy, with the most exquisite tenor voice, named Carlo Capano. Now, I just turned 80, and I don't know if Carlo's out there, but if you are, you inspired me with your beauty of your feeling and voice. And I can't imagine O Holy Night, or so-called Canti de Noel. I always think of Carlo Capano.
Well, that's the beauty of it. That
really,
is the beauty of it.
Really,
I hope
is.
He does hear that. Mr. Cohen, Mr. Christmas, my high school choir teacher at JFK High School in Plainview, Long Island, New York, will have his list of suggested a cappella songs at hearnow.org. Mr. Cohen, shalom, and Merry Christmas.
And a Merry Christmas, and I say Joyeux Noël to you.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news. Tiny Tim has been blessing everyone while Jacob Marley shakes his chains at Ebenezer Scrooge for 176 years. We're, of course, referring to Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. It's long been adapted for screen and stage, and now a theater initiative in Colorado adds fresh poignancy to Scrooge's redemption story. Colorado Public Radio's Avery Lill reports.
A woman in coattails and a curly bob struts to the center of a snow-strewn stage. It's Ebenezer Scrooge, angry and bickering with everyone in sight. It's a cross-gender cast by necessity. The crew and actors are all incarcerated at the Denver Women's Correctional Facility. The inmates are performing to a full house at the University of Denver's Newman Center. It's a public venue, and their three performances sold out. Patrice Poli has been in prison since April. She could be eligible for parole this spring.
This is like a dream. I just feel honored and privileged, and I think it's so awesome that our DLC has enough trust in us and enough faith in us to bring us out here into the public.
The Colorado Department of Corrections, the DOC, is partnering with the University of Denver's Prison Arts Initiative to make life inside prison as much like life outside prison as possible. It's highly unusual for inmates to take a show on tour to the public and other prisons as this troupe is. The way DOC's executive director, Dean Williams, sees it, it's a matter of safety.
Where things are the worst and the most dangerous is where us versus them lives big. And this experience reduces us versus them. And whatever happened in the past, you're still paying for that. You're still going to pay for it when the show is over. but you're on a mission. We're on a mission together.
And that idea that the past is unchangeable, but the future is full of possibility, is central to A Christmas Carol. After the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future show miserly Scrooge how he hurts people and drives them away, he, or in this case she, screams to the ghost of Christmas future.
Why show me this? If I'm past all hope, assure me that I yet may change these shadows you have shown me by an altered life.
Jamelia Nelson, who plays young Scrooge, tears up backstage when she hears that monologue. Nelson has served 12 years for first-degree murder. She'll be in for at least another decade.
I would never say we deserve our freedom when we've taken from society, but the fact of the matter is we're going back out into society. So to have society on our side, you know, not opposed to us, is just profound, and we're crying for that redemption.
Most of these incarcerated actors will eventually be released, but statistically in Colorado, half of all inmates, male and female, will end up back in prison. Reentry into society is a challenge. It demands soft skills, such as appropriate emotional expression, compromise, and determination. Prison can be a hard place to practice. Nelson and DU Prison Arts Initiative Director Ashley Hamilton see theater as a place to build healthy relationships and practice self-expression before inmates are released.
They're going to, you know, be our neighbors, they're going to work with us, and we want folks to come home feeling set up to be successful so that they can stay home and so that no more harm can be caused.
In the meantime, inmates are acting out Scrooge's second chance on stage. For NPR News, I'm Avery Lill in Denver, Colorado.
It seems like there wasn't a day this year that we didn't hear something about immigration. From policy changes like Remain in Mexico to stories about deaths and dismal conditions at detention centers, 2019 was a significant year in immigration news. We wanted to take a look at one of the major developments, the change to the asylum process. And for that, we have with us Muzaffar Chitthi, director of the Migration Policy Institute at New York University School of Law. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with one of the more gripping stories of the year. The biggest outcry was over the treatment of unaccompanied minors or children separated from the adults they arrived to the country with. Upwards of 70,000 this year. That's actually a record. And then there were the changes to the Flores Agreement, which limits the amount of time they can be held, 20 days. What is the status of the limits on how long children can be held now?
When the Flores settlement was agreed to, it was supposed to be followed by regulations issued by the government which would implement the agreement. It is true that the government over the years has chosen not to issue any regulations implementing that till the Trump era.
Mm.
It was this year in the summer of this year that the Trump administration finally said, we're going to issue those regulations. And under the regulations, they wanted to increase the flexibility they would have for keeping the kids longer than 20 days and in places which do not necessarily meet with state requirements for licensing, state licensing requirements for keeping kids. And they argue in the reg that they issued that federal licensing for keeping kids should comply with the requirements of the Flores Agreement. That regulation was quickly challenged before Judge Dolly G in Central District in California, who's been supervising the agreement, and she issued an injunction in September, basically ruling that the regulation does not meet the requirements of the Flores Agreement, so therefore Flores Agreement stays in place.
Mm-hmm. This is definitely a story that we'll be continuing to follow throughout 2020 and beyond, I'm sure. Another big story was the number of immigrants entering through asylum or through refugee status. And I want to first ask you, we're going to delve deeper into this, but what changes have we seen this year in the way migrants have typically been able to come to the country?
So 2019, I think, will go down as the year when we started dismantling the modern asylum system as we know it. There really is no other way of putting it. I think one should point out that the president had made immigration obviously a central focus of his campaign, and the wall as a particular focus of that. I think what happened is that he really believes that he got elected on the narrative of building the wall. But when he showed up in the office, he realized that wall was essentially outdated for the kind of pressures of migration we're we're facing today, that people are not coming to the border who are single Mexicans sneaking through the border, for which wall would be a solution. That's not the phenomenon of today. The phenomenon of today are families fleeing from Central America, openly seeking a Border Patrol officer, asking him or her for asylum in the United States.
So you're saying, really, he realized that there was a different reality there. And so much of what we're seeing, really, is the implications of him really finding out that it was not, as you said, a wall that would fix this. It was something that was much, much different than this and much more complex.
Exactly. It was a different flow of people, which is not what he had run on. It just is the reality hit you the moment you have to implement what you said. And therefore, he said, my God, so these people are all applying for asylum. So we have to do something to blunt the magnet of asylum. So we did a number of things. First, we approached Mexico to say that, look, you really should be controlling your southern border and your northern border to prevent large number of people reaching the southwest border. Just straight ask from one government to the other. The second thing we did right in the beginning of 2019, I think in January of 2019, we started implementing something called migration protocols, popularly called Remain in Mexico. And we said, sure, if you arrive at our southern border and you apply for asylum, we will give you an asylum hearing for some time in the future. But during that time, you'll wait in Mexico. That's what's called the Remain in Mexico program. And obviously, that people thought would act as a deterrent from people coming to the southwest border.
Yeah.
That program has been in effect since January, and about 56,000 odd people have been sent back to Mexico under that program.
Right, and what we're seeing now is camps of folks because of that protocol that are in Matamoros who are just in limbo. They're just in place there because they've been sent back, and they don't want to go to their home countries or go back to their home countries.
Exactly. And after the MPP, the second most important development in demolishing the modern asylum system, and the most far-reaching, is that in July of this year, the administration issued a new rule saying that if you show up at the southwestern border seeking asylum, but if you have come through a transit country, then you should have applied for asylum in that country and had been denied, and only then are you eligible to apply for asylum. Now, you don't have to be an immigration lawyer to know that almost everyone other than a Mexican national who shows up at our southwest border has come through another transit country, which is Mexico. So it basically says that if you transited through Mexico, you should have applied for asylum in Mexico. And only then, if they denied it, would you be eligible even. That essentially disqualifies almost everyone other than Mexican nationals from applying for asylum in the United States. And that rule was challenged very quickly. And that went to the Supreme Court very quickly. And this year in September, Supreme Court allowed the rule to go ahead. So the transit country rule now is one of the most important tools that the government has in its hands to deny even eligibility to a large number of people seeking asylum in the United States.
Is this indefinite?
Well, it's indefinite till the next administration changes it. And this is, you know, this is why I think it hasn't gotten that much public attention, that this is the most significant development. The third most important development in asylum in 2019 is that in addition to the remain in Mexico and the transit country rule, is that the administration had signed agreements with three Central American countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. These are called asylum cooperation agreements. They're not called safe third country agreements, which our statute allows. And under these agreements, if anyone shows up at the southwest border, we can send them, instead of allowing them to apply for the asylum in the United States, we can send them to any of these countries where they can seek asylum. Mm. So if a Honduran, instead of being returned to Honduras, can be sent to Guatemala and ask him or her to apply for asylum there. Again, this is another front which we have opened to diminish the number of people that are even eligible to apply for asylum at our southwest border.
What will you be watching for in 2020?
So in 2020, we will be watching an extremely important Supreme Court decision regarding the Dream Kids. The terminology for this is the DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It will rule on that case in probably in the spring or the summer of 2020. It will come smack in the middle of a very charged political season of election. And so whichever way the Supreme Court rules, it's going to become a very important new point of discussion in the elections in 2020.
That's Muzaffar Chithi, Director of the Migration Policy Institute Office at New York University School of Law. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Researchers have long known that Americans work longer hours than their counterparts in most other wealthy countries. And we've all talked about why that is, including more recently the technology that lets many of us work around the clock. But now a new working paper uses a name for this trend, neurofacturing instead of manufacturing, get it? And they say it's especially pronounced among white-collar workers because that's how they advance, by working more than their colleagues. It's what Derek Thompson calls an arms race that produces mutually assured exhaustion. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does every Monday. Derek, welcome.
Hey, great to be here.
So this working paper, published by the National Bureau of Economic Research, tells us, gives examples of just how much more white-collar work Americans are doing. How much?
Yeah, it's important, I think, to lay the groundwork first. As you said, the American worker, the typical American worker, works longer than her counterparts in just about every similarly rich country in the world, you know, Japan, Canada, the UK. In fact, you know, we think of the Germans as being insanely industrious, but if the average American worked as much as the typical German, she or he would have 30 extra days off per year. Mm-hmm. That's a free six-week vacation just for embracing the work schedule of Germany. Mm-hmm. So that is sort of the base level that we're dealing with here. But in this working paper, the researchers looked at hours increased in the last 40 years of work and basically found that hours worked by higher earning Americans, by white collar workers, increased by 10% in the last 40 years. This is really historically strange. For most of economic history, as cultures get rich, as people get rich, they work less. Think about the landed gentry of England. They had all this leisure time, and it was the poor serfs who had to work throughout Europe. But today, that trend is switching, and it's the rich who are working longer, a trend that I've looked at in several articles that I sometimes call workism, that we've somehow made overwork a kind of modern religion.
Right, a secular religion. We've talked about that. And we've also talked about how because we have the technology, we can work around the clock. I was thinking that a few decades ago, I couldn't do editing at home. There were these big systems that lived only at work. Now it's on my laptop. I love doing editing at home until you're doing editing at home all the time and you've got a facial tic. I mean, what are some of the other factors? Yes, there's the technology, but they have technology in other countries as well. You talk about how, you know, particular American industries that are, you know, huge in this country, like consulting and banking, that plays a part too.
Right. So, yeah, let's dig into this word neurofactoring. Obviously, manufacturing, man, that's making stuff mostly with your hands. Neurofactoring is the concept that a lot of modern white-collar workers are making stuff mostly not with their hands, but essentially with their minds. I guess you can include their hands because they're typing on their keyboard. But this is a category of neurofactoring that includes artists, journalists, people who work in consulting or startups, anyone whose job is to constantly solve new challenges, answer new questions. They work in neurofactoring. And as you said, you know, there shouldn't be this enormous nostalgia for, you know, old-fashioned industrial labor. You know, you had lots of work in the late 19th century, early 20th century that was often literally backbreaking. And today it's not backbreaking to sit on your couch and edit an article or edit a radio piece for hours, but it does mean that the operating equipment of the 21st century is a portable device. And that means the modern factory isn't a place at all anymore. It's the day itself. We can take this portable equipment wherever we are and work at the office, at home, at the library, at a friend's place. We can theoretically be as productive at 2 a.m. as we are at 2 p.m. And as a result, I think you have a lot of white-collar workers that have this really fraught relationship with work, where on the one hand, yeah, they can do work that's a lot more fun than, you know, harvesting, sperm whale oil out of a decomposing whale's head in order to light our lamps. You know, modern work is a lot more fun, a lot safer than that, but it comes with this side effect of overwork.
Well, a couple things. First of all, there is a lot of work today. We know that's still very dangerous and backbreaking, and there is a bigger divide now between these white-collar workers we're speaking of and blue-collar workers. We'll put that aside for another day. But another factor here is that some of these industries, we mentioned consulting, they demand this fealty from their workers and this round-the-clock, round-the-world kind of, you know, job. But also, in the minute or so we have, you know, a lot of workers, as you point out, know that their bosses are clear. Whoever works the most gets ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're really, really smart, I think, to break this into at least two categories. You know, 150 million workers, there's a lot of people to cover when we're talking about, you know, the state of modern work. But on the one hand, I think it's absolutely true that you have among workers in blue-collar industries a lot of underwork, a lot of workers who would like to work more hours but can't find it, or those hours are terribly distributed throughout the week. And there's an entirely different problem among white-collar, richer workers, which is what I'm talking about here in terms of overwork. These are, as you said, different categories. But one thing that's definitely emerged in the U.S. economy in the last 40 years is that workers at banks or consulting firms, they've learned that if they put in more time, the bosses will give them promotions, thinking that they're basically wedded to their job. And so here you have this expectation among 20-somethings, maybe early 30-somethings, to put off the trappings of a typical life, devote themselves to their job in the hope that eventually they'll make that partner track. But this essentially is, it's a bit of a trick that the employers are using on these workers in order to persuade them to give up everything outside.
Right. I love the phrase, mutually assured exhaustion. Derek Thompson,
yes.
Senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.